listening again in the background with Mr. Clifford Brown on the KEEL Radio 6 p.m. Friday News. And I'm Hassan, and this is what the first Friday in February 2006, 2 days after my birthday.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna read a great story from the it's an obituary from the LA Times obituary. We lost an interesting, very courageous fighter this past week, a gentleman by the name of Stu Albert. He was one of the co-founders of the Yippies. And I was reading his obituary. He was 66 when he died. They have a pretty young picture of him in the paper. But I was reading his obituary, and he did a lot of things that probably give us a lot of freedoms today. And let me pod down Clifford Brown here. Remember, there's no engineer at KEEL Radio. Okay, we're engineer free. And my name is Hassan, and this is the 6 p.m. Friday News. It's Clifford Brown in the background. And again, this is the Los Angeles Times, February 2nd, 2006. It's the obituary for Stu Albert. Stu Albert. And it's by Elaine Wu. Stu Albert, a co-founder of the Youth International Party. The Youth International Party, the mischievous countercultural organization whose members were known as the Yippies, died of liver cancer Monday in Portland, Oregon. He was 66. A Brooklyn native who wound up in Berkeley in the mad 60s, Albert helped launch the Yippies in 67. With Abbie Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Paul Krosner, and others. The group was best known for its highly theatrical pranks, such as running a pig for president in 68. Albert was clubbed by police in the mayhem surrounding the 68 Democratic National Convention in Chicago and was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Chicago 7 trial. The charged Hoffman, Rubin, Tom Hayden, and other anti-war movement leaders with conspiracy to incite a riot. He played a role in the creation of People's Park in Berkeley and helped found the Free University there. He later ran for sheriff of Alameda County, where he challenged the incumbent to a duel. He lost everywhere but Berkeley. Since 1984, he lived in Portland, where he was a freelance writer, active in radical circles. He was very funny. Hayden, the former California legislator who roomed with Albert in Berkeley, recalled in an interview Wednesday. He had the ability to blend easily into any setting, from Yippie to Black Panther to New Left, partly because he had an infectious sense of humor, and partly because he was well-read and capable of understanding a lot of viewpoints simultaneously. He was very much a self-made intellectual, quote-unquote. Albert poked fun at his image as a sidekick to Hoffman and Rubin in a 2004 memoir, quote-unquote, Who the Hell is Stu Albert, end quote. Jeffrey St. Clair, co-editor of the political newsletter Counterpunch, called Albert's book, quote-unquote, one of the best chronicles of the 60s, and the ongoing cultural and political fallout from that strange creative decade, close quote. With his wife Judy, Albert also co-created, quote-unquote, the 60s Papers, a document-based history of the air published in 1984 that is a widely used college text. They assembled the book on a computer, but with the help of a settlement from a successful lawsuit against the FBI, which had planted an illegal surveillance device under their car in the 1970s. Born December 4th, 1939, to a working-class family, Albert was deeply moved by a visit to Cuba when he was 21. When he returned, he traveled around the country, eventually landing in Berkeley in 64. There, he joined the Anti-War Vietnam Day Committee, met committee co-founder Rubin, and plunged into countercultural politics. He ran Berkeley's 1967 campaign for Berkeley mayor, which emphasized social justice, ending the Vietnam War, and legalizing marijuana. That same year, Rubin appeared before the House Un-American Activities Committee dressed as a Revolutionary War soldier and set the mood for the brand of guerrilla political theater that would become the Yippies' chief tactic. In 1967, Albert went to the New York Stock Exchange with Rubin, Hoffman, and others to make a point about greed. From the visitors' gallery, they threw 500 $1 bills at stockbrokers. Trading stopped as everyone on the floor grabbed the money. Other antics were just as zany, such as when Albert joined Rubin and Hoffman at the massive anti-war march on the Pentagon later that year, when they made headlines with an announcement that they would exercise the military complex of evil spirits and levitate it. Albert often served as a peacemaker between Hoffman and Rubin, Kreisner said in an interview Wednesday. His mediation skills were crucial in what became one of the Yippies' most famous pranks, running the pig for president. Quote unquote, there was a lot of competition between Jerry and Abby. Abby had gotten the pig. Quote closed. Kreisner recalled, quote unquote, Jerry complained that it was not big enough or ugly enough to appease Jerry. Stu went with him and got a bigger and uglier pig, end quote. They called it pigocious. Our big contribution was our theatrical approach, Albert told the San Francisco Chronicle in 2004. We tried to be inventive and creative in developing tactics, and we had the belief that if we did, we could change the world. Years later, he said that the imagination of the Yippies eventually became their downfall. Quote unquote, after a while, our imperative tended to be developing stunts rather than counter institutions, end quote, such as the Free University in Berkeley that he helped found in 65, he told Salon.com in 2000. Albert, an early supporter of the Black Panthers, often served as its liaison with the Yippies in one of the 60s strangest escapades. He helped smooth the way for Timothy Leary, the acid-dropping counterculture guru who escaped from a California prison on drug possession charges in 1970, to find haven in Algeria with Aldrich Kleber, the Panther leader, who was himself a fugitive. Leary and his wife, Rosemary, were at first received as guests, but later became prisoners under quote-unquote revolutionary arrest at Cleaver's villa. Albert served as go-between for a tense period during Leary's Algerian confinement. Cleaver eventually released Leary, who returned to prison in California. Quote-unquote, he was on the front lines of the counterculture, Kreisner said of Albert. Todd Gitlin, the 1960s historian who teaches at Columbia University in New Albert in Berkeley, recalled Wednesday that Albert later became a private detective. He helped Gitlin and others obtain government files kept on them through the Freedom of Information Act. Quote unquote, this was an example of his sense of humor, Gitlin said. It seemed marvelous that he had gone from Yippie impresario to private eye, close quote. After moving to Portland, he remained politically active in groups that battled racism and promoted Arab-Jewish dialogue. He ran an online site called the Yippie Reading Room and continued to blog until shortly before he died. He is survived by his wife Judy Gumbo Albert and their daughter Jessica. And that was it in the Los Angeles Times obituary section yesterday, February 2nd, 2006. The obituary for Stu Albert, who was one of the co-founders of the Yippies. Sounds like a good guy to me. And this is Kill Radio 6 p.m. News. And let's go back into a little Clifford Brown. And then I'm going to I'm a little confused here. Got here late. And like I said, there's no engineer here. And of course, the show before me had repatched the board. So let me get the control board back together here. And then we'll come back on with, we're going to listen to, I have some great, a great short James Baldwin piece. It's always just good to hear Jimmy's voice. I love James Baldwin. God, he's one of my heroes. And then we're going to go into Ward Churchill, the professor out in, I think, Arizona, who is being being attacked right now. I don't know what's going on. I haven't heard. At least a couple months ago, he was really being attacked by the right wing out there. But we're going to hear a speech by him and a little bit of James Baldwin after. Let's first go into Mr. Clifford Brown on Trumpet. Let me see if I can bring him up here.
Jump up at dawn, shake out the sun, laugh like a loon, everything is fun, it's crazy, but I'm in love. I act like a fool, what do I care? I'll be a fool as long as you're there. It's crazy, but I'm in love. I spread my wings and then I fly all around the city. The world's my sweet potato pie, and I'm sitting mighty pretty. I sweep out the stars, chase that old moon, fall into bed humming a tune. It's crazy, but I'm in love, 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 love. It's crazy, but I'm in love.
what Rosa Parks was saying in Montgomery in 1956, and what those Negroes were saying when they were marched for 389 days, the country did not want to hear and did not hear. And as time rolled on, and kids, including people like Stokely Carmichael, were being beaten with chains, thrown into jail, marching up and down those dusty highways, trying to change the conscience of this country, still nobody heard, and nobody really cared. And poor Martin spent most of his time in and out of jail, as all of us know, trying to redeem what we claim we live by, the principle of love your neighbor, the principle of if it happens to you, it's happening to me. The principle John Donne talked about, you know, when he said that any man's death diminishes me. But in this country, race and Christianity and power are so tied together in self-interest, what one takes is self-interest, that no one heard it. It's only now that people are beginning to suspect that something terrifying has happened, and with our consent, because we do know that we cannot fight a civil war, which is what this ferment is about, because I am your brother. I was born here. My father's and my father's blood is in this soil, and nothing will drive me from this country. It also belongs to me. You cannot fight a civil war and a global war, too, at the same time. And especially if both are predicated on the same principle. And I'm not now accusing the Americans of being wicked. I'm accusing us of having allowed ourselves to be brainwashed into a state of ignorance which allows us to forget that the peasant in Saigon and the peasant in Detroit are the same people. And what we don't know about the peasant in Saigon is what we don't know about Sambo here. And that has destroyed the American sense of reality. And I suppose what we're here to do tonight is to begin to correct that. Now, people who can believe that I was happy on the levee picking cotton, or happy in the mines digging coal, and giving all this away to other people for their wealth, and unable to protect my house, my woman, my children, are people who can believe that I did this out of love for other people, and that I was happy doing it, and that all those songs and dances I learned while I was doing it meant that I was happy, can believe anything. And I'm afraid that the people who claim to represent us in Washington these days, from the president on down, do believe that. And do believe, as they believe so long, that they have the right to tell me how to live, and are unable to begin to suspect that other people, Sambo, for example, can teach us a great deal about how to live. That's all I have to say, really. Thank you.
Thank you very kindly for your heartwarming applause.
Okay, guys, that person you just now heard was Mr. James Baldwin. Actually, the first time I think I ever heard his voice. And thanks for listening. This is Kill Radio 6 p.m. Friday News, and I'm Hassan. And let's go into let's go back into Clifford Brown on that great trumpet. His group. We heard Max Roach a minute ago on drums, and Donna Washington singing. They're all on this Max Roach CD. Maybe we'll get lucky and hear Max Roach right now. So let's go back to this Max Roach CD, and then we're going to go into War Churchill. Okay, so again, this is Kill Radio, 6 p.m. Friday News.
Now I'm going to try. Thank you.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Ward Churchill on the History of the FBI. On the 26th anniversary of the firefight on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, the Native American professor, activist, and author, Ward Churchill, spoke in honor of Leonard Peltier. Peltier was sentenced for the murder of two FBI agents, a murder he and others say he did not commit. Even Peltier's prosecutor agrees. 8 years after the trial, Lynn Crooks said, "We really have no idea who shot the agents." Still, Leonard Peltier remains imprisoned today. And you are about to hear a well-researched analysis of the forces that keep him imprisoned. Foremost among them are the FBI and the counterintelligence programs developed by the agency almost from its inception in the early 1900s. Ward Churchill sketches in this talk FBI intervention into the IWW, the Molly Maguires, anarchists, the Communist Party, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Panthers, and many other organizations. Finally, in the 1970s, the full force of the FBI COINTELPRO experience was used against the American Indian movement as well. The conflict at Pine Ridge came about because the federal government had arranged for the transfer of 1/8 of the reservation land to federal ownership. They had discovered uranium and molybdenum on the Sheep Mountain Gunnery Range. When traditional elders resisted the violation of their treaty rights, the Bureau of Indian Affairs gave tribal president Dick Wilson money to create a tribal ranger group, the Goons, in return for his approval of the land transfer. By the time that the American Indian movement, among them Leonard Peltier, arrived at Pine Ridge, upon request of the traditional elders, 69 tribal members had been killed by the Dick Wilson goons, among them women and even children. The FBI had refused to investigate any of these murders, so a small group of AIM members came to the aid of the treaty rights movement. You will hear in a moment in more detail what happened on Pine Ridge. Here are just a few more words on the speaker. Ward Churchill is professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also a Vietnam veteran and survivor of the 1970s American Indian movement. His many highly acclaimed books include The COINTELPRO Papers, Indians Are Us, and A Little Matter of Genocide. This is the first of a two-part history of the FBI that goes far beyond the events on Pine Ridge. Here is Ward Churchill.
CO. Procedure. Hello, my relatives. It's good to see you here. My name, as I was introduced, my colonial name is Ward Churchill. I bring you greetings from the elders of the Lynx Clan, of the Catua Band of Cherokee, my mother's people, the elders of the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement, of which I'm a part, and from Gwarthy Las, otherwise known as Leonard Peltier, who tonight, as I speak to you, and as I assume all of you know, continues to sit in a cage at the federal prison, Leavenworth, Kansas, not for anything anyone, including his prosecutor, at any point in the past 15 years has been prepared to say they actually believe he did, but rather as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations of indigenous people within its claimed boundaries to liberation. This is the anniversary of the firefight that occurred at Oglala Village on the Pine Ridge Reservation, 1975, which, according to the official histories, two FBI agents were murdered by Leonard Peltier. They convened an investigation, unprecedented in its intensity in the history of the FBI, to investigate what they called the reservation murders, and that meant the two agents. Nobody ever investigated the death of Joe Stuntz, who was buried alongside another casualty of the counterinsurgency war that was conducted against the American Indian movement and traditional resistance of the Oglala Lakota on Pine Ridge Reservation during the mid-1970s, Anime Aquash. Both are buried on the Jumping Bull property where the firefight occurred. So before going further, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence in respect and memory of those two fatalities and the well over 60 other American Indian people who died during the course of that counterinsurgency campaign in three-year period, 1973-76. We have to remember those who have struggled and sacrificed. We have to remember where it is we've come from in order to understand where it is that we find ourselves, where it is that we are. And only in understanding where we are can we plot a course to a better future for our coming generations. These things are connected. And it's that understanding that motivated Leonard. It has motivated others and has to do with the formation of his case. Because Leonard Peltier is not simply a political prisoner, although he is that. Leonard is a prisoner of war. He is a prisoner of the longest ongoing war in this hemisphere, having at this point lasted a little over 500 years. That's 500 years of conquest, colonization, and genocide. It's also 500 years of consistent resistance on the part of those who were targeted for that. American Indians hold treaty relations with the federal government of the United States, 400 of them duly ratified by the Senate under the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, as well as under international law, as is reflected in the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. Treaty relations are compacts entered into only by co-equal sovereigns, that is, by fully sovereign nations. Every time the United States ratified a treaty with an American Indian people, it provided a formal recognition that the other party or parties to the treaty was a nation in its own right on an equal standing entitled to the same rights as the federal government of the United States itself. So you have this recognition that there are nations other than the United States within the U.S. portion of the North American continent, all of which are subordinated directly to the presumed authority of the federal government of the United States for purposes of extracting their assets, their wealth, for the benefit of the dominant society to the detriment of the indigenous owners. And you have the catastrophic kinds of consequences to the people, to the population, that accrue from all such relationships. That's the nature of the set of circumstances that was confronted by the American Indian movement in the early 1970s, the most forcefully on the Pine Ridge Reservation, because what it was that was being done was the assertion of the rights to sovereign control over lands, lives, and destiny that is inherent to the treated status of American Indian people and is inherent to the fundamental human rights of any people under extant international law. It's the assertion of those rights which precipitated the counterinsurgency war, which brought the repression down. And that takes us to the FBI. And the function of the FBI, which, as any of you who grew up watching Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. be inspector, whatever his name was, on the FBI on TV, you understand to be the preeminent law enforcement agency, the federal law enforcement agency in the United States, the preeminent investigative agency, having to do with the rule of law, catching criminals, amassing evidence, providing it to prosecutors, furthering the due process and prosecution of those who are guilty of violations and seeing to it that they get their just deserts, that they serve prison sentences or whatever. That's the myth. And the myth predates the FBI TV series. It runs back virtually to the inception of the Bureau. Ultimately, it was an entity created right from the get-go to take the order of business as it encountered, business as usual, and preserve it. That the status quo, the structuration, socially, economically, and politically in the United States is such that there is a place assigned to everyone, at least by virtue of their membership in some rather arbitrarily defined groups. Groups like, oh, I don't know, blacks, Asians, South European immigrants, women, homosexuals, American Indians, Appalachian miners, and other poor whites. Name a group, there's a place. And the function of the Bureau is to make sure you stay in your place. And for people whose place is relatively privileged, that's a good thing. People who are not privileged in this social structuration tend to attempt to change the social structure and circumstance to better their lot. And that's what the FBI was created and developed and perfected to prevent. Now, remember, as we go through this, that the place assigned to American Indians is to serve as resource colonies internal to the United States so that there can be extraction of strategic and commercially valuable minerals and other things fueling the American economy while American Indians starve to death or freeze to death in the localities which they were consigned during the formation of the reservation period. And that's what it was, the American Indian movement, Leonard Peltier, the resistors on Pine Ridge, and others elsewhere were bent upon changing. When did this begin? Because you're always hearing, you know, there's some really nasty stuff going on. I mean, look at the Rodney King case. After all, there's another case down there in New Orleans where the police were running this racketeering enterprise, shaking down and sometimes murdering tourists and drug dealers as well. And then there's this falsification of evidence in order to take drug dealers out of the community in Philadelphia while the police take over their drug distribution networks. And then there's the LAPD, and then there's the Chicago PD. And, you know, if things keep going on this way, we're going to end up in a police state. Well, maybe we want to interrogate this beast a little more to find out if we really have a need to be concerned that we're going to end up in a police state, as opposed to maybe at some point, and the question would be when, already got there. Instead of trying to prevent something, we need to be figuring out how to undo something, and it's a radically different project between those two things. Bureau started in 1913. It really gets on the map with what are called the slacker raids, and that was using the American Protective League, coordinating its activities to run around and grab young men off the street, several thousand of them in one afternoon, to demand to know why they weren't in military uniform, and demand proof that they had registered with Selective Service for the draft, and so forth. And that was the warm-up, okay? That was to see if the system worked for what they really had in mind. What they really had in mind was the Palmer Raids that occurred a year later. And the Palmer Raids were a roll-up, lock, stock, and barrel of the anarchist and anarcho-syndicalist movement that was quite pronounced in the United States at that time. You had approximately 15,000 people arrested overnight, all of them arrested on the basis of nothing other than that they were recent immigrants to the United States. They were held until they could be sifted out. What they were sifting them for was to find out if they had any sort of an affiliation to a radical organization in their old country, if they subscribed to an anarchist magazine, and so forth. And those that were found to have these kinds of alignments were considered undesirable on the face of it, no hearing required. They were all put on a boat and transshipped, not to the countries of their origin, but to Russia. Now, there were a few Russians on that, but you're talking Southern Italians, you're talking East Europeans of non-Russian origin, you're talking Greeks, you're talking a few Germans. All of them go to Russia, because by 1919, you've already had the Bolshevik Revolution, and we need to keep all these people.
Okay, everybody, right now we're listening.
Totally arbitrary.
Let's see, you're listening right now to War Churchill, the Arizona State professor, Native American, who who's very anti-Bush, and the Republicans out in Arizona are making him pay for it. There's a big thing going on right now about his credentials. I don't know. I know it was about a couple months ago. It was like one of the most biggest news stories in that state. I haven't followed it in a while. But anyway, we're going to go out listening to this, to Ward speak. I think he is an interesting person to listen to. I wouldn't even mind taking his class if I was a little younger and a student there. Sounds like an interesting professor. let's see. So this is the 6 p.m. Friday news. We're going to sign off in about 10 minutes. Xenophone is in the house, and Xenophone will be coming on the air at 7 o'clock. And we're going to go off, sign off the air with listening to Mr. Ward Churchill, who you've been hearing for the past 10 minutes. And check me out this Monday night at midnight for Straight Ahead Jazz, every Monday at midnight. And then I'll be back again next Friday for the 6 p.m. Friday news. Oh, and if you want to hear anything that you – if you want to archive it or listen to anything that you hear on Kill Radio or on my any of my shows, go to radioforall.net. That is radio number 4all.net. Or it should be – I should be posting it on our Kill Radio homepage within the next couple of days, anything that you heard. You got to hear a great speech by James Baldwin today. It was pretty short. But it isn't very often that we get to listen to James Baldwin. So let's go back into Ward Churchill here on America's number one internet radio station.
Political maneuver.
Kill Radio.
Theoretically, the FBI did not engage in much political activity thereafter for a period of almost 20 years. Theoretically. That's the way the standard histories read. But the standard histories don't read as consequential movements of, say, African-American people. Because during the 1920s, the FBI's main focus was on something called the United Negro Improvement Association and its leader, a Jamaica immigrant by the name of Marcus Garvey. And UNIA, well, had some things in common with the Black Panther Party, had some things in common with the Nation of Islam, had some things in common with several other organizations, but aside from having things in common with them, it had its own blend and happens to have been, to this day, the largest mass organization of black people in the United States history, ever. And Garvey was targeted for a technical stock manipulation, sent to maximum security prison, Atlanta, Georgia, and ultimately deported back to Jamaica, ended up in Africa, broke the back of UNIA, the organization came apart, and that was exactly what Hoover wanted, and had been wanting for a long period of time. 1918, there's a very interesting memo that's reproduced in one of the books that's available over here, COINTELPRO Papers. This is on first investigation by this young file clerk come anti-radical bureau head named J. Edgar Hoover, when he says, "We've conducted an investigation of Mr. Garvey and his activities, and unfortunately, we couldn't find that he's in violation of any law." So you expect him to go on to say, "We're going to wrap up the investigation." However, that's his word, not mine. However, if we continue the investigation, undoubtedly, we'll eventually find something. And eventually, being 7 years later, they did find that technicality. That was a political targeting. The argument will be made when you bring that up and a lot of other instances as well that, well, Garvey did violate the law. So you may not like the severity of the dispensation of punishment, but by God, he violated the law. So he got what was coming to him. Well, there's a little principle, constitutionally speaking, in the United States that has to do with equity before the law. And yeah, on some peripheral technical charge, Marcus Garvey undoubtedly did engage in what would be stock fraud. Not that he pocketed any of the money. He simply spent the money on a business other than he offered the stock for. Made the investment there. The stock offering was made for a company that was solvent. He put the money into an insolvent company. Okay? That's the nature of the offense. He went to prison for it. On the other hand, you got this other guy whose name may resonate. It was Joe Kennedy. Anybody ever heard of Joe Kennedy? Father of a late president? Yeah, Joe Kennedy, whose manipulations of the stock market based on money that he had made being in consort with Meyer Lansky and other bootleggers in New York City led in large part, or significant part, or at least tangible part, to the collapse of the stock market in 1929. Now you're talking about engagement in fraud big time. And what was it they did to Joe? Well, they hired him in the Treasury Department to write laws to prevent people from doing what it was that he did. Let him keep the money, and as a reward, when he was done drafting the legislation, made him the first Irish ambassador to the court of St. James. A little different from the punishment meted out to Marcus Garvey, wouldn't you say? The difference being, maybe a matter of complexion. You see, J. Edgar Hoover, aside from disliking radicals with a certain unadulterated intensity, had this little thing about skin tone and other physical characteristics that did not match his own, which is why he referred to Martin Luther King, for example, with a genteel nickname of the Burhead.
Thank you.